Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. You're tuned into Muslim Vibe. Muslim Vibe is on the air, broadcasting on American Muslim 360. We've got our co-host, Imam Nadeem, on the road. Are you there, sir?
Assalamu alaikum. Yes, I am.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. MashaAllah. Okay, we're in. I'm in the underground bunker at an undisclosed location, broadcasting this news from Muslim Vibe. We've been on the air now for a couple of years, every Sunday, mashallah, at 1 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Looks like we got a bunch of callers. I mean, this is really loyalty. Not only do we go on the air and start talking and then people tune in and listen, but we got a few callers, mashallah, lined up before the show goes on the air. So, like I say, once in a while, brothers and sisters, don't try this at home. This is for the... this is for the OGs, and you've got a main one there on the other line, Imam Nadeem from the West End, on the road at the MANA conference. That's the Muslim Alliance of North America up there in Washington. How's things going up there, sir?
Yeah, it's not what it is. It's not MANA. It's the they're having the inaugural gala, the Muslim inaugural gala tonight. They have one tonight here and one tomorrow where the Muslims are doing an inaugural gala. They've invited some of the luminaries from the Washington, D.C. area, as well as honoring nonprofit organizations. And I'm on the board of Share Atlanta. And so Share is being honored for the work it's been doing in the Atlanta area, along with a whole group of other nonprofit organizations. And so we'll be there tonight. I think Preacher Moss is going to be emceeing. I think Native Dean is going to be there, Azhar, and a lot of local people. So it should be a good...
Azhar Usman, right?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
oh, what a wonderful, wonderful entertainer and a beautiful brother.
Yeah. You're having two of the three Allah made me funny guys.
He's the one. As I prepare a couple of notes for today's discussion, we usually start off with Al-Fatiha. Do you know why or how that beginning of the show didn't happen?
No, it usually just comes on, so Allah knows best...
Allah knows best. That's why I waited a few seconds. Yeah. Anyway, to start it off, since yesterday was a big party for my lovely wife, and I always, have dreams of her saying certain things to me, I'm going to let Aretha Franklin say it. We'll be back in like 3.5 minutes. Here we go.
Stop, I'll be there to feed it.
Franklin from back in the day, Daydreaming. Daydreaming and I'm thinking of you. Man, I'm telling you, what a song. It still lives on with the beautiful tradition of the background singers in the DNA of the African-American rhythm and blues to have what they call the call and response format. Isn't that really how you would describe that, Imam?
There it is. There's a call and response.
You know?
And it's straight from the West African musical tradition.
It spills over into so much of the African-American art forms, and not only R&B, but soul and jazz as well.
You mean African-American music with an African-European melodic expression, with an intense feeling for free improvisation.
Yeah. See, subhanAllah. I remember Art Blakey, the Muslim brother Art Blakey, who passed away about 8 years ago. On the liner notes of one of his Blue Note albums from the 60s, he said, "We have African rhythm with American harmonies. Put it together, and man, watch out." Yeah.
Abdullah Buhayna.
That's it. That was his Muslim name, subhanAllah.
Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
We have such a rich
years ago.
Oh, wow. We have a rich history about the convergence of African-American musicians and from the jazz idiom who came into Islam in the 60s and 70s. And we
even
just spoke about
the 40s.
Idris Muhammad last week. Even
yeah, even
back
way
to
back
the
to the 40s. Back to the 40s.
Right.
Even they said Charlie Parker, before he died, he had a brother there reading Quran to him in Arabic while he was on his deathbed.
Oh.
You know, so there was, you know, you had the Ahmadiyya movement was very strong during that period. And so you had a lot of people who was at Dakota Staten and her husband, they were Muslim.
Yeah.
And so you had a lot of people, Sahib, Sahab. I mean, if you look at some of those old albums, you see a large convergence of people who were Muslim, who were also in the jazz field. And even Dizzy Gillespie.
Sahib, Shahab.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Idris Suleiman, who moved to Switzerland, yes. Idris Suleiman. So there was a ton of people. You go back to the 40s and 50s. Jamil Nasser, whose son is doing broadcast. He just was in Atlanta a couple of years ago doing interviews on American Muslim. He lives in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia now. But Jamil Nasser was one of the top 10 bases on the planet at one time. And, you know, he played with Ahmed Jamal for many years, who, again, you're talking about Miles Davis looked up to.
Right.
Ahmed Jamal is in his 80s now. So you have, you know, people need to do the research on that, you know, the contributions of Muslims in the arts. There's several books written on that as well, about Muslims in the arts, and specifically jazz.
It's a very, very important field. I mean, for our young people that might be listening and now or in the future, you've got people like Yusef Lateef, Ahmed Jamal, McCoy Tyner, known as Suleiman, very important people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Many of them came to Islam through the Qadiani movement.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them stayed with that movement, and then many of them came to what you call mainstream Islam, what they used to call Orthodox Islam. Because of the presence of the Nation of Islam in our country, there was a distinction made when they said someone's a Sunni Muslim. It didn't mean that they're a Sunni instead of a Shia. It meant that they were Sunni as opposed to Nation of Islam. And,
Orthodox,
you know, there was always that kind
that
of tension.
Term.
Orthodox, yeah. These are the terminologies that were used. And now, hopefully, with the new generation of highly educated and dedicated Muslim youth in our country, hopefully this kind of, I don't know, what do you want to call it, sectarian divisions that are so prevalent in many of the less educated parts of the Ummah, hopefully that sectarianism will evaporate and it won't be able to stand on its own. These kind of discussions that prick the conscience of the historians and the people that have, you know, a very wide view always gets the ball rolling. And, yeah, it's a good topic. Well, it's almost first.
We forgot about Pharaoh Sanders, Abdul Mufti.
Oh, man. Yeah,
songs named after surahs of Quran. This guy.
Oh, yeah. He had songs named
Tawheed.
Tawheed,
yeah.
The Creator has a master plan. We're going to bring a brother in now. Well, I don't know. We have a caller from 317. I'm going to bring the caller up. Are you there?
Yes, sir. I'm late.
Well, brother. Nice to hear you. Yeah,
yeah,
so you'd like to say something about this topic. Go ahead, sir.
Yes, this is Ron Foster Sharif calling from Indianapolis, Indiana. I wanted to also include that John Coltrane himself was studying Islam real heavy, and that when he put out that record,
A Love Supreme,
that it was originally entitled A Love Supreme.
Mm-hmm.
The Turkish owners of the record label, I can't remember those brothers' names.
Right.
That they went round and around with him to force him to change the name from Allah Supreme to A Love Supreme. Thank you, brothers. As-salamu alaykum.
Well, Islam, that's a very good point. I knew that, and if you listen to it, you know, some verses of the, if you listen to the song, you'll hear they subtly sing Allah Supreme, not saying Allah Supreme.
And if you listen to the vocals, yes.
Mm-hmm. And then many of his relatives in Philadelphia are Muslim. His first wife was Naima, and then many of them are still practicing Muslims here in North Philadelphia and in Philadelphia area, you know,
right.
A lot of his
right.
descendants of Naima are still around.
Right. Well, this is really giving some of our listeners some of the backdrop. It's great to have a brother like him from Indianapolis calling in and knowing such a detail that only a dedicated, you know, historian, a music, lover, a lover of culture and art and the beauty that Islam brought to the world. Could he have, that position and that understanding? And I'm so glad he called in, because that's really a great bit of trivia, because Coltrane himself, you know, when you think of Coltrane, you think of McCoy Tyner. When you think of Coltrane, you think of Pharoah Sanders. When you think of Coltrane, you think about the whole idea of evolution of the art form to a spiritual, you see, plane, where the music became more than just notes on a page. It became an experience. I mean, when they crossed over from, if you want to call, the standard blue note, gold standard of the jazz tunes, how they were constructed with the head, and these are musical terms, the head being the main melody, then it breaks up into the solos in the middle, where the same chord changes are done by the rhythm section and the soloist, whether they're horns or percussion or whatever, and then they come back to the head, which matches the beginning of the song. Well, that was the gold standard, and still is in many ways. But Coltrane, correct me if I'm wrong, took it to a different level where he raised the awareness and consciousness of the textures of the chords and the multiplicity of simultaneous notes, and came up with a sound that they called sheets of sound, where the expressiveness of the saxophone player, in his case, was basically, paving the way to what we called avant-garde and consciousness-raising music. And it was that plateau, now that I'm looking back, now that I'm over 60 now, I'm looking back, and it was that plateau that opened up the gateways for so many artistic and spiritual African-American sincere people to come into the fold of Islam. I mean, that's really it. I mean, Gary Bartz, all these cats, Lee Morgan was killed because he didn't want to come into the faith, and his wife Khadija, It was really, man, what a family setup that was. But these are some of the details of those days.
Yeah, it's a good topic, and based on your interview with your daughter Zainab last week, talking about the whole issue of African American Muslims in Atlanta or in Georgia, and if we stretch that out throughout the country, there's just a wealth of information that's being buried by time that we have to pick up and digitize so that future generations will be able to look back and say, wait a minute, okay, they've been here.
Yeah.
Some expression of Islam always in this country, and so it's not a new thing. And these are some of the things that we have to document and archive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the legacy of Islam in America is so intertwined with the African-American experience. And as you know, Islam has always been based on the convergence of the Hijra and the Nusra. In other words, the fact that Islam, one of the main features of it is, and the appealing features of it is, that it's always been local and global at the same time, simultaneously, meaning you have people from other countries as well as the locals somehow finding their feet together and working together for the common good. And this has been something that has won the hearts and minds of people on, six continents everywhere but Antarctica.
So we have to just open up the mind. That's the goal of what we do here on Muslim Bai. What's going on around the world? There's a lot of stuff going on around the world.
Yeah.
We want to take a break and come back? And
I was gonna hit my favorite button about working for peace, and then in about 5.5 minutes, we'll come back and hopefully bring up this conflict in Mali, which is an outgrowth of a conflict in many other areas, and we'll talk about some of those global issues. And if any of our callers want to direct the show, of course, we also oftentimes are a caller-driven show. Before we take this break, we'll tell our listeners, both nationally and all over the world, and we have so many that we don't even know about that are listening. And if you can listen live, that's a great thing. Sundays, 1 p.m. Eastern time. However, our shows are immediately archived onto the site blogtalkradio.com. That's blogtalkradio.com. And if you go there and put the words Muslim Vibe into the search engine, then you'll see what'll come up is about 100 of our previous shows. So that you can listen to this show or recent shows or the old shows at any time you like during the week. But if you want to call in live, now would be the time. So we'll be back in a flash with the cash. Here's our friend, the late, great Gil Scott-Heron. This is called Work for Peace.
Back when Eisenhower was the president, golf courses is where most of his time was spent. So I never really listened to what the president said, because in general, I believed that the general was politically dead. But he always seemed to know when the muscles were about to be flexed, because I remember him saying something, mumbling something about a military-industrial complex. Americans no longer fight to keep their shores safe, just to keep the jobs going in the arms-making workplace. And then they pretend to be gripped by some sort of political reflex. But all they're doing is paying dues to the military-industrial complex. Military and the monetary. Military and the monetary. Military and the monetary. The military and the monetary get together whenever they think it's necessary. They turn our brothers and sisters into mercenaries. They are turning the planet to a cemetery. The military and the monetary use the media as intermediaries. They are determined to keep the citizens secondary. They make so many decisions that are arbitrary. We're marching behind the commander-in-chief, who was standing under a spotlight shaking like a leaf. But the ship of state had landed on an economic reef, so we knew he was going to bring us messages of grief. The military and the monetary were shielded by January and went storming into February. Brought us pot-bellied generals as luminaries. 2 weeks ago I hadn't heard the sumbitch, now all of a sudden he's legendary. They took the honor from the honorary, they took the dignity from the dignitary, they took the secrets from the secretary, but they left the bitch an obituary. The military and the monetary, from thousands of miles away in a Saudi Arabian sanctuary, had us all scrambling for our dictionaries because we couldn't understand the fucking vocabulary. Yeah, there were some smart bombs, but there were some dumb ones as well. Scared the hell out of CNN in that Baghdad hotel. The military and the monetary, they get together whenever they think it's necessary. War in the desert sometimes sure is scary, but they beamed out the war to all their subsidiaries. Tried to make so damn insane a worthy adversary, keeping the citizens secondary, scaring old folks into coronaries. The military and the monetary, from thousands of miles in a Saudi Arabian sanctuary, kept us all wondering if all of this was really truly necessary. We've got to work for peace. Peace ain't coming this way. If we only work for peace, if everyone believed in peace the way they say they do, we'd have peace. The only thing wrong with peace is that you can't make no money from it. The military and the monetary, they get together whenever they think it's necessary. They've turned our brothers and sisters into mercenaries. They are turning the planet into a cemetery. We've got to work for peace. Peace ain't coming this way. We should not allow ourselves to be misled by talk of entering a time of peace. Peace is not the absence of war, it is the absence of the rumors of war and the threats of war and the preparation for war. Peace is not the absence of war, it is a time when we will all bring ourselves closer to each other, closer to building a structure that is unique within ourselves because we have finally come to peace within ourselves. Military and the monetary. Military and the monetary. Military and the monetary. Get together whenever they think it's necessary. They have turned our brothers and sisters into mercenaries. They are turning parts of the planet into a cemetery. What you gonna do? Military and the monetary. Military and the monetary. What you gonna do? We hounded the Ayatollah religiously, bombed Libya, and killed Gaddafi's son hideously. We turned our back on our allies, the Panamanians, and saw Ali North selling guns to the Iranians. Watched Gorbachev slaughtering Lithuanians. We better warn the armies, they may bomb the Pennsylvanians. The military, the monetary. Get together whenever they think.
Before they start bombing the Pennsylvanians. Now that's a brilliant line right there. I'm happy that we've hit that button because it really does kind of set up the next discussion, this song Work for Peace by Gil Scott-Heron, because, you know, the right makes fun of the left tries to humiliate the right, and we always like to say no war for oil, and then the right wing, you know, the Fox News types, say, oh, no, it's not war for oil, it's war for, you know, win the hearts and minds and give those people freedom and democracy. I mean, you know, we've heard this 100 times, right?
All over the world, from Vietnam to Afghanistan.
What's wrong with those Vietnamese, man? 50 years ago, we tried to give them all that beautiful democracy and freedom and liberation, and boy, they didn't take it. I mean, you can say the same thing about the Iraqis. You know, what's wrong with them, man? We're trying to give them democracy on a silver platter, and they're just refusing it. So, I mean, how many times can we be stupid to listen to these kind of arguments? But the problem is the left wing doesn't know how to win. That's where the warm and fuzzy feelings are. You know, the anti-imperialism, anti-Zionism, anti-racism, anti all these other, you know, dirty isms. And you feel real good about it, but they don't know how to win. The right wing, they come with all the, you know, force first and kill them first and let God sort them out. But they know how to win. And so this is a big frustration in the world right now. And this thing in Mali is an example of what is the real game. They make fun of us when we say no war for oil. Brother, what's the only untapped continent with more resources than the rest of the world combined? It's called Africa. What's that region that hasn't been touched and plundered and raped like the rest of the world? Africa. So, hey, man, now Uncle Sam, the rest of the big powers, now they're using so-called Muslim radicals, call them Al-Qaeda or whatever, you know what I mean, to do their dirty work, so it gives them the pretext to go in. I mean, what else, how many times can they play the same game, and we Muslims are standing there, you know, picking our nose, wondering what's going on? That's the setup, anyway.
And that's your story, and you're sticking to it.
Hey, man, it's like all about resources. I mean, you know, the right likes to make fun of the left, that they say it's all about resources and oil. Hey, brother, it's exactly what I'm saying. They have untapped resources, call it gold, diamonds, or whatever, and now they've got, you know, like that Afghanistan war, Charlie Wilson's war, that movie, how they, you know, primed up an Islamic fundamentalist group to do their dirty work for them. I mean, you know, you had the godless communists occupying Afghanistan. Well, how do you get them out without putting your soldiers' feet on the ground? Oh, I get it. Why don't you find a group that believes in God so much that they weren't ready to die for their beliefs, boom, here comes Bin Laden, here comes CIA, here comes ISI in Pakistan, here comes Saudi money, and here comes the Taliban. Hey, man, people like you and me, we've been in these trenches for decades. If there was ever a group named the Taliban, we probably would have known about them. But all of a sudden, they came out of nowhere
and then took over the whole country. It steamrolled right through Afghanistan.
Give me a break.
You know,
we would have known about them if they really were legitimate.
And it's
we
all
study
about
these things.
The opium market, and it's all about using putting a pipeline through that country so that they can, you know, get cheap oil into Europe.
Right. We hire people with PhDs who know about these things, and they didn't know where the Taliban came from. So I just said it. Bin Laden, CIA, ISI, Pakistani intelligence, Saudi money, here you go. Ultra-Wahhabists, you know, austere vision of, you know, the cutting of the limbs version of Islam. You see what I'm saying? The stoning of the women in public, the beheadings, the things that when the people see this, when it's done unjustly, they say, hey, man, if that's Islam, thanks, but no thanks. I don't want it. So all of a sudden now these people in Africa coming in from different countries, and see, when America and the West cannot make a deal with a group, when they can't get that group to, like, come to the table and have some, you know, tea and ice cream and let's make a deal, then that group is, quote-unquote, Al-Qaeda representative. And so then, I mean, they got it set up, man. They got the whole Muslim world by the short and curlies, because they can set it up the way they want. And when they can't talk to them, they say, oh, that's Al-Qaeda. And then they have the excuse to go in. And in this case, we're not even going in yet. We get the French going in. Why? Because France has historic ties to North Africa, you know, almost all of Africa. And instead of America taking the heat, being the bad guy, let's let France take a little slack right now. They need probably a few billion dollars. So, you know, let's let them go in. So this is really, unfortunately, what's going on over there. And then you have within the Muslim community itself that natural tension that exists between the so-called people of Sufism, the mystical path, and the so-called ultra-Wahhabist, known as neo-Salafi types that want to go by the letter of the law versus the spirit of the law, like the Sufis.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically the grounds that have been drawn, the ground lines have been drawn. Allah knows best.
And, you know, the French, they have a wretched history in Africa. There's a movie that I would recommend to our listeners called The Battle of Algiers. And it will show you, because the French have always promoted themselves as beret-wearing, you know, fun-loving people. But this movie, The Battle of Algiers, shows how when the Algerians fought against French colonialism, who was it, Ahmed Ben Bella, I believe. And how when they fought against the French. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that movie just shows the savagery that was unleashed against the Algerian people. And that's my big concern about Mali, when you have this so-called Salafist threat there. And so you go in there like they're going in there. And again, America has war fatigue right now. So as you said earlier, they're not wanting to go in. So it's more, okay, France, you come off the bench. And then later on, they'll have Britain come off the bench. And so therefore, you know, we're coming out of Afghanistan, coming out of Iraq, but you have others who are in the club going in. And it's another form of recolonization of Africa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe that's really what's going on over there. And it's so unfortunate that, in general, the Muslim world stumbles and limps from one catastrophe to the next because of the lack of unity on the primary goals of the Ummah. And everyone has their agenda. And you have what we call the rise of ideology as opposed to the rise of traditional Islamic knowledge, because if they were in the traditional Islamic knowledge field, they would see the natural beauty and the brotherhood and the very positive aspects of how Islam and God changes the world by entering the hearts of mankind. But if you're just like an ideology and you've got three or four points you that have studied about Islam, you've got a kind of a half-baked intellectual leader that, you know, 6 months or 6 years ago, he was in the nightclubs chasing skirts and drinking Chivas Regal, and now all of a sudden he wants to be a Muslim again, and he thinks he has to be more pious than the Prophet, you know what I mean, and starts talking all this smack about, yeah, man, jihad, and all this stuff. Meanwhile, they don't even pray on time. You know, so you have a lot of these recruits that can be easily sucked in. They come from these culturally backward areas of the world where their only attachment to Islam is, you know, their circumcision and the halal meat that they eat, and they have no real progressive academic background. And all of a sudden, like I say, these half-baked intellectuals come in with their slogans, and you believe that that's all of the deen right there. Boom, whatever this guy says, he's done it. They're working on people here in America. The brothers have just come out of prison, and they've been sitting in the joint, and they've been sitting there for 7 or 12 or 18 years, and they read these books from that particular line of thinking, and they come out thinking that that's the first and middle and last chapter of Islam, not realizing that there's a very wide range of Islamic diversity, knowledge, different schools of thought, etc. But they come out thinking, no, man, I'm going to make my own school of thought, and I'm going to call it Quran and Sunnah, and later for you guys to have other, you know what I mean? And so
it's my way of the highway mentality.
Yeah, man. Anyway, I'm glad by the grace of Allah we have so many listeners on the line right now, and we're talking about this important topic, starting off with Mali, but and Brother Kwame from upstate New York sent me a phenomenal video about the situation in Mali. I believe he sent it yesterday or the day before, and it was a piece on RT showing exactly what I said in the setup, that it's about resources. It's about getting your hands on other people's resources. You've installed this, wishy-washy president he won the election in southern Mali, and he's the legitimately elected people, but he's easily overthrown. And you bring in your big-time, quote-unquote, Islamic warriors in the north, because these third-world countries, as you know, the president, Imam Nadim, is really the president of about 9 blocks in the downtown of the capital. Meanwhile, as soon as you go outside of that, it's, you know, you're on your own, Jack, you know what I mean? And certainly these massive countries in Africa have, these central governments have no control over the far-reaching areas of the rural areas of their country, you see. So
it's just like in Afghanistan, they call the Karzai, they call him the mayor of Kabul, because he can't go outside of Kabul without getting, you know, taken out.
Exactly. Yeah, and he's talking smack, too. He's talking about how Afghanistan is going to be so much better off when America leaves. Now, here's the guy that America created. Halliburton created him. He worked for Dick Cheney. He's one of these guys that, you know what I mean? Come on, man. Let's not talk bad about our brother. He's not here to defend himself, but, yeah. He's signed
here.
He's
here in Virginia, and they plucked him from Virginia and put him there. He was living in Virginia, where, you know, at least the people over there struggling stayed there.
And so he's talking smack about America should leave. Meanwhile, America, if they leave, man, he's like, he'll be sweating like Sarah Palin taking a geography test. I thought you'd like that little line. Yeah, man. So we have, mashallah, many listeners. I sometimes, if they don't like my taste in music, sometimes I notice that some of the callers leave because they don't like my taste, or maybe they don't like music at all. But anyway, and then when we come back, mashallah, we get a full bank of callers calling from all over the country, listening. Like I say, Muslim Vibe is on the air every Sunday. We really talk about these, I'd like to say, very important, pressing topics from an Islamic perspective, neither seen nor heard on the dominant media. And so we got a lot of very high-end listeners. If you want to participate in the conversation, you know what to do. The call-in number is 646-716-4478. And to participate, just press 1. We'd like to get your take on what's going on over there in Mali. You know, how related is it to other conflicts going on right now? Are the so-called Salafis that look upon this thing with great pride, do they know that they're being used by the superpowers? Or is it simply, you know, Allahu Akbar, I'm ready to die for Islam, or my interpretation of Islam, and never knowing that they're being taken to the cleaners and they're doing the dirty work of the shaitan. Allah knows best. This is, you know, these struggles. Most of these kind of fighters, these so-called Al-Qaeda types. And then again, we talked about the Taliban, Imam Nadim, And people like you and myself have been around 30, 40 years and studied the global Islamic movement from every angle. And we know PhDs who have studied every, you know, neighborhood and precinct of the Muslim world. Just like we never heard of the Taliban, we never heard of Al-Qaeda either, Jack. That's why I keep on saying with tongue-in-cheek that Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, they're probably the emirs of Al-Qaeda. This is what they created. We don't know about that group. If they were legitimate, we would have known about them. So, I mean, they create this group. They make it so that any Muslim they can't talk to must be an Al-Qaeda guy. So, you know, that's also not fair to them. And on Al Jazeera the other day, they showed this Syrian brother, what's his name, Abu something, you know what I mean? Everyone has a nom de guerre. I love it. Nobody has their real name out there, and I can understand it. Everybody is Abu something, El something, you know. Just pick a name, Hassan. Okay, I'm Abu Hassan, then El Yemeni, or El Amiriki, or El, you see what I'm saying, Lubnani. They just pick a name. So everybody's got a nom de guerre. But this brother was saying, look, I'm not ready to make a deal with anybody. I'm just fighting for the cause of Allah. I want to be on the side of the oppressed people. And it's those people, unfortunately, that when you can't make a deal with them, they say, oh, that's an Al-Qaeda-affiliated group. So it gives the big powers the ability, the pretext that they need to go in. So tell me, brothers and sisters, am I blowing into the breeze here? Am I sneezing all over myself? Or
no,
is this a line of thinking that is legitimate?
That's exactly what happened in Afghanistan. As even people who weren't affiliated with Taliban or Al-Qaeda, they, if they weren't ready to deal with the U.S., because, you know, there was some, I've talked to some of the soldiers who were over there, and they were Muslim. Many of them were Muslim, and they would tell me, you know, that they became very disheartened because when there was a Muslim group that would deal with the United States, they would go in and they would get the other group who would deal with them to kill them off. And, you know, here you have these Muslims who, Americans who wanted to fight in the military and felt as though they were protecting America. They got over there and they became really disheartened at the level of Islam that was being practiced in Afghanistan in particular. If your group wouldn't deal with the West, then the group who would be, okay, they said, well, okay, show your loyalty and go take them out. And so it was a really, it was a gangster move on the part of the U.S. In Afghanistan. And like I say, you're going to see similar things in Mali, and people in France, England, the U.S., you have to stand up against this. As Gil says in the song that we often play, you have to work for peace. It's not going to happen just through osmosis.
Mm-hmm. You work for it, and that's the cause that we're all about here. Mashallah, like I said earlier, the callers, I'm looking all over the country, North Carolina, Baltimore, Tampa. Some of these zip codes I don't know about, but hey, we got someone right here in the 404. Let me bring this caller up, wants to participate in the conversation. Brother or sister, are you there in the 404? I pressed the button to get that red. Here we go. Is that better? Can you hear me, 404? Okay, I guess. I'll hit it one more time. We got a caller from 404-518. Are you there? I think what happened, see, a lot of our callers, they see our publicity, and it says press 1 to participate, but I think they don't read that. I think they just call the number and then press 1. So, hey, it's all good. So we keep on going here. We've got listeners all over the world as well on the Internet, I'm sure. Who probably are not calling in. Maybe they'll call in on Skype. I remember we used to get calls from Saudi Arabia and Malaysia and other places, and I'm sure they listen to us either live or during the week. Like I mentioned about a half hour ago, all of our shows on Muslim Vibe are archived onto the site blogtalkradio.com. And you can go to that site anytime during the week and just put in the words Muslim Vibe in the search engine. And you'll see approximately 2 years of our previous shows. You can listen to, for instance, most recent, most relevant, oldest shows, whatever. And mashallah, we've got some quality journalism here going on every Sunday. So, yeah, that's really one of the topics that we have to bring up and become more familiar with as to how these Muslim groups are deluded and how they're brought brought into these conflicts and how they recruit people for these conflicts. And unfortunately, one group of Muslims, in this case the democratically elected government of Mali, has to call France to protect them from the other group of Muslims. And this is, of course, a field that you and I have talked about in the past, how it seems that when Muslims, Muslim groups don't agree on certain points with each other, instead of trying to get along and reach some consensus, we just kind of dog each other, and in this case, calling in France to fight against their opponents to keep them in power. So that's the macrocosm. The microcosm is seen locally in our own mosques with our own friends.
And if you take that attitude that we see, you know, locally in every mosque around the country, the masjids throughout the country, you know, like you said, you give, and all, we don't have any power, we don't have any money. And imagine if we had power and money, resources, and had a land base. It would be those same types of arguments and bickering going on. And so it's
right.
Important for us, on, you know, at this level, to really get a good understanding that what Imam Jamil used to say to us all the time, hey, we're not the only serious Muslims. And, you know, he sought, you know, throughout his career to coalition build, to work with different groups. Okay, if you don't want to, come under my leadership, let's have a treaty with you, you know, based on bartering and trading and protection, mutual protection, you know. And so that those are some of the things that, you know, I was educated in, that you know, that your group, no matter what your group is, what your belief system in regards to and the way you approach Islam is, you're not the only serious Muslim on the planet. There's like 1.5 billion of us. And so nobody's going to follow
your
one sheikh or your one imam. Mm-hmm. And so, but we can talk to one another. We can work. There are certain things, food, clothing, and shelter that we all need.
Right.
You know, we want safety. We want, you know, we want good things for our family. So we all have commonalities that we can work together on.
Mm-hmm. I mean, let's look how the progress has been made between, let's say, the community of Imam Jamil Alameen, that you are the imam of there. And, of course, many years ago there was some, you know, suspicion of bad blood between that group and the ministry of Imam W.D. Muhammad. And there was, you know, not a whole lot of love lost between the groups. But here we are some years later, and with the evolution and the moving forward of the Islamic movement in America, wouldn't you agree that there are many points of contact now with the two groups, and that they work together in a nice way? Didn't they allow all of us into the big Atlanta Masjid on one Eid when we had it on a different day than the majority?
Yeah, you know, there's you know, a lot.
10 years ago,
of
that would
contact.
Have been unthinkable.
You know, probably 5 years ago, for the most part. But we worked together. And, you know, with Imam Pleeman, you know, with Imam Mansour, and so, and even with the Majlis here in Atlanta, we do a lot of work together. And, like I said, we've come a long way, got a long way to go. And, you know, but the main thing is that we recognize that, you know, we are, you know, the Islam is a garden. It's very diverse. And we have to respect that and respect each other's community. If I'm on that side of town, I'll make prayer there. And they're on that our side of town, they'll come and make prayer with us. And so and then there's the issue where we do the Muslim Day together yearly, as well as especially the inner city masjids. We all have we've prayed together for Eid for the past several years. We worked together to establish that. So it's been a lot of work done. And that's, it didn't happen, like, you know, in show business, they say it takes 10 years to become an overnight success, you know. And so it didn't happen overnight. It took work on the ground with people who were concerned about, because we recognize our kids, you know, they play together, they pray together, they go to school together. And, you know, so they're going to be the ones to really take it to the next level.
That's exactly true. The youth, our children and grandchildren are the ones that are going to make this thing permanent and strong and vibrant in America for years to come. I look at my grandchildren and I, you know, I just try to shoot ahead 15, 20 years. Allah knows best if you or I will be around 20 years from now. I hope we will be. Allah bless us with long age. I just like to see what's going to happen with our beautiful grandchildren. And they're in good hands with Allstate, you know, with our good children that we brought up. And so that's a very good topic to discuss. We invite our listeners, of course, to participate, and I'd like to also set up our next segment by talking about the fact that we are in the famous weeks of Rabi al-Awwal right now, and of course the Prophet, peace be upon him, the mercy to mankind, the mercy to the worlds, was sent by Allah with this great divine message of Islam. Many Muslims who follow, if I could say, a popular version of Islam, do note his birthday, and they say that this is a very important thing, and it's a good reason, and, you know, really, you don't need really any excuse to get together and talk about the Prophet. But then again, you have some other Muslims that, you know, have more of a literalist approach, may Allah bless them and guide them, where they say that, wait a minute, you can't get together and have a good time about anything other than the two Eids, like, you know, end of Ramadan and the end of the Hajj. So in other words, you have, again, you have, as you well know, sir, one group of Muslims condemning the other. When this week comes along and the people have this, what they call Mawlid, which means birthday, and they get together on the Mawlid of the Prophet, they bring, you know, poets, and they make beautiful nasheeds and kind of nice, beautiful salutations that, you know, praise the greatness of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. Then that one group that doesn't want to participate, you know, they stir the soup up real bad and, you know, call them all kind of innovators and all this kind of stuff. Is it as if Islam is only one or two or three things, and if it's not in that little tunnel vision, then it's not Islam? Well, sorry, brother. I mean, you know, the world's very big. Islam is very vast. You have to be very open-minded and understanding to understand even part of Islam. But anyway, that's the setup right there. So, of course, I remember back in Iran, back in, back in the 1979 revolution, the birthday of the Prophet came up for discussion in the parliament. And I thought it was very interesting because the way they handled it, of course, Iran is basically a Shiite population. And the Sunnis always say that the Rabi al-Awwal is on the 17th of Rabi al-Awwal. And the Shiites always say, no, it's on the 12th of Rabi al-Awwal. In other words, I'm not sure. It might be reversed. For the sake of simplicity, for our beautiful listeners, one group, whether it's Sunni or Shia, they say it's the 12th. The other group says it's the 17th. So it came up in the parliament. I thought this was really remarkable because the late Ayatollah Ali Muntadhari said, why do we argue every year about if it's the 12th or the 17th? Why don't we, as a parliament in the Islamic Revolution, why don't we just take the whole week from the 12th to the 17th of Rabi al-Awwal, and call it the week of Muslim unity, the week of the unity of the Sunni and the Shia. How do you like them apples? It was a beautiful thing. And then during that week, because the Muslims basically have, you know, taken over the resources of the country, they said, we're going to invite, like, you know, 200 Sunni scholars. Here is a Shiite state, right? We're going to invite 200 Sunni scholars and about 20 Shiite scholars, like only 10% of the Sunnis, from like India and other, you know, Bahrain, wherever, you know, Lebanon, wherever Shiites live. So here you have the Shiite state inviting 200 Sunni scholars every year at this week of unity, and a few Shiite scholars to go with the resident Shiites of Iran, of course, which is, you know, in the millions. And so they have a week of unity with great programs of unity. But here, of course, in our area of the country, we have some mosques that follow the Mawlid and others that condemn. It's not that they don't do the Mawlid. They indeed condemn and put out to pasture those people who do the Mawlid, right? So to make a long story short, I'm sorry to ramble on like this, but it's really, I'd like our listeners to get in on this. So the other day, I'm at one of the other mosques, right? I'm affiliated with the mosque that does the Mawlid. I don't particularly participated in the Mawlid, but I don't tell them they can't do it either. I'm on the board, you know what I mean? And so They have the Mawlid. So I'm down at the other mosque down the road that is the condemning the Mawlid, and when they see me walk in, it's like, you know, I feel like I'm a Muslim. I go to any mosque in the whole world. You know, this is my planet. I go to any mosque I want, you know. But I'm kind of in strange territory now because they're shocked to see me in there. And so, of course, after the prayer, the imam takes the opportunity to make a small speech, and he said, oh yeah, there are those Muslims, those misguided Muslims, oh, making bid'ah and innovation, and oh, they praise the Prophet too much, and this is not part of Islam, and this is un-Islam, you know, in other words, you know, just dogging them. And he even goes further, you know, since I'm sitting there in the front row, He says, and it's un-Islamic to raise your hands in this way like a dua and say Ameen after the imam, as if that's also an un-Islamic practice. Excuse me, what planet are we living on? And how many billions of Muslims do the dua and say Ameen and celebrate the birth of the great prophet of Islam? So in other words, instead of them having the intellectual integrity to say, let's have a debate about this in public so that the Muslims can see that there are more than one side. Instead, we Muslims tend to only talk to the, you know, preach to the converted or the choir, preach to the choir, as they say, and they only stay in their small little cul-de-sac, and they cannot tolerate being challenged on any point like this. So this is a problem. This is something I think our listeners could address. And, of course, we're willing and able to discuss these topics at any time. Imam Nadeem, this is like a cancer in our society, the fact that we disagree on something and we have no intention of debate, consensus, understanding, realizing that we, all Muslims, work on the same team, play for the same team. Instead, we waste all that time among the haters.
And then also we have to understand that there are cultural practices within Islam. And as you said, as opposed to just, okay, well, that's not something I will do. If, you know, a person comes from a country where that was a main cultural celebration for the most part, then,
yeah,
you know, leave them alone for the most part. Does it take away from this deen in one iota? You know, and
right,
then again, and as opposed to promoting your point of view, you spend time putting down another person's point of view. And I'm always reminded of this story about, there was a scientific workshop in Saudi Arabia, and there was this scientist, I believe he was from Thailand, and then he was not the mainland China.
Taiwan.
Yeah, he was from Taiwan, and he was interested in Islam. And so then you had a person who was from this and that, talking to him, no, this is what it's supposed to be about. And this, another person from another madhab came, and at the end of the day, the man did not take his shahada because of all the dissension and all the confusion that was sold based on the way the people who were madhabis, who basically they were just so stuck in their madhabs, this man did not come into the house of Islam. And so, and that's, you know, one of the things, your madhab is supposed to be a way in which you approach and worship your Lord. It's not supposed to become a deen in itself. And they scared this man away from the religion. And it happens a lot when you have people come into Islam, the new Muslims come into Islam, and they think, you know, the religion of unity. We're talking about the unity of Allah. And then, you know, we don't see unity amongst the followers, you know, of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and it disheartens people when they don't see this, and then see the mutual respect that you were talking about earlier. That, okay, if that's the way that you see it, then mashallah. If you're of this madhab, then that's the way you see it, mashallah. You know, but don't try to impose your way and your view on me, your worldview. Because there are cultural practices and there are religious practices, and we have to, look at it from that perspective. You know, people over here celebrate birthdays, you know, for the most part.
Yeah.
Cultural practice. That's a cultural practice.
You don't have to say that Islam is part of the deen or not. It's not a big deal. Nothing to get all tied up in a knot about.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we're approaching the top of the hour. Mashallah, we've got a full bank of callers. I've got a sister, Samira El-Siraj. She's got a beautiful little poem here called I Was the Little Muslim Girl. We'll be back in a few minutes, folks.
I was the little Muslim girl you made fun of, and you never bothered to ask yourselves why. And I bet if you saw me today, you would be too ashamed to look me directly in my eye. But to me, this wouldn't come as any surprise, because I would be ashamed of me too if I spent most of my time trying to break a 13-year-old down and make her cry, trying to bring about her demise. But it wasn't me that felt shame. Deep down inside, it was always you. Because even though this was high school, you was acting like you was in middle school, and sometimes you even dumped it down to preschool. So of course I was confused. Supposedly, I was the backwards one, but to me, it was always you. For some reason, I thought that all of you being bigger and older would make you more mature. But instead, you made every attempt to make me miserable the second I walked through the classroom door. Every dumb joke, stupid antic, and different forms of abuse you threw at me for sure. I guess being small, being alone, being Muslim made me hard to ignore. And every laugh you got from the class made you write another score on your board. Call me stupid when I was obviously the class nerd. And if a war was handed out, my name could always be heard. Skipped a grade, on the honor roll, part of the gifted program, and most definitely made better scores than you. But that's just book smarts, because trust me, I had plenty of common sense, too. I value life and held myself to morals in a way that you never could. I had sense enough to fear God and live my life in the way that I should. So who is the stupid one, you or me? Because not just about this life, but also the one after. Even at 13, this was something that I could see. You called me a bald-headed monkey when I had hair to reach the middle of my back. If you wanted to know why I wore a headscarf, all you had to do was simply ask. And I don't mean asking the way that you did, voice full of scorn, like you couldn't possibly understand why I would cover my head and why I was Muslim-born. And from my head, my scarf was torn, and gone was your look of scorn replaced by a look of awe and then fear. In your head, you had to duck because my fist was coming near. It was satisfaction you felt, but what I felt was the disrespect. And your level of ignorance is something that I could never forget. To me, it was like snatching off my pants and my shirt, treating me like I was less than a human, something that couldn't be hurt. I was the one you call funky and stank when the average Muslim washes up more than you do. If you have ever bothered to do your research, we have learned we have something called gusa and wudu, obligated to purify ourselves for the sake of God and simple cleansingness multiple times a day. If you ever spent time around a Muslim, you would know that being filthy is definitely not the Islamic way. Rather than seeing the truth for what it was, you decided it was more fun to crack cheap jokes, hurl religious slurs my way, calling me a funky monkey every other day. Then, like a dummy, you would turn around and ask if I bathed in lakes, did I shower with that thing on my head, did I wash my feet 5 times before I climbed into bed. Dirty or clean, obviously your jokes couldn't decide, just as long as I was the butt of your jokes and everyone laughed in the side. But it wasn't me that I was unclean, that's how it belonged to you, because God don't like ugly, and that's something I choose to hate too. You used me for target practice and threw things in my back, but didn't have the guts to say it was you when I turned around angry and asked. I wasn't the one scared. I realized later that was you, because I always sat in the front row no matter how much stuff you threw. I always walked solo while you always had to be in a group. I didn't have a problem turning my back because I wasn't afraid to come at you face to face. Even at times I felt fear, the taste of courage in my mouth was potently laced. So against your assault and threats, my back was readily braced. Walking like a soldier was a concept I readily embraced. You only smiled and acted nice when you needed to copy my answers or when you needed some help. And though I didn't want to, at times I relented because I wanted the kindness that Muslims usually show to be felt. I didn't want to be forever fighting fire with fire, though the fake smile on your face proclaimed you to be the biggest of liars. To you, this was cool, and you laughed inside thinking I was the biggest of fools, but I knew that it was me that would win and it was you that would lose. You didn't break me. And I'm surprised you thought that you could. I know every day you sat there convinced that you would. But just like you had a strong will, I had one too. And I was determined to never ever give in to people like you. No matter how harsh, I simply didn't allow my eyes to cry. I felt pride to be Muslim when it was you that I walked by. You threatened to jump me, leave me on the ground to lie. But I never ducked in corners or proceeded to hide. Yes, it was me, that little Muslim girl that you sometimes made feel pain, but I felt the blessings even more in the strength that I gained. In the days you nearly brought me down, my love of God and myself lifted me back up, and I realized that I was stronger, that I would never give up. You only made me cling to my religion even more, and I held my head high when I walked through that door, looking straight up and never down at the floor. With my face aligned, my eyes were the only things that you could see, but every day I made it clear that I would forever be me. You hated me, and I'm sure you thought that I hated you too. I didn't hate you, but I wanted the freedom to live the life that I choose. I was just a little kid trying to come to the school. My Muslim identity, something I was expected to lose. But you got to be you, so why couldn't I be me? I was told that this was the land of the free. This is the land of my birth, but I guess my religious affiliation is the measure of my worth. And if I'm not a Christian, I guess that means that I'm equal to dirt. And when I came in, your thoughts were filled with every intention to hurt. And I know you told yourself that it wasn't just you, and I know that I wasn't the only kid that was picked on in school, but what if it was you instead of me? Would you have felt quite the same? Would you have seen it as a fun little game? Would you have felt the scorn targeted because you were Muslim born, feeling upheaval and emotions torn? You didn't bother to walk a mile in my shoes or even realize that it was my right to choose, because it could easily be you instead of me when someone persistently trying to make you bleed and feel shame because you didn't look the same. We make our own choices, and I understand it's religious issues all over the place, but instead of choosing to leave things be, you chose to single out me. You chose to continue an ugly cycle that's ruining our world. But what if it was you instead of me that was the little Muslim girl? I'm asking you now, what if it was you instead of me that was the little Muslim girl?
Mashallah. Boy, the emotions and thoughts and urban realities of so many things that our sister was talking about really make it quite a poem there. So that was a special treat for our listeners today, Sister Samira El Siraj, entitled "I Was the Little Muslim Girl." Man, the things that we got to go through in the land of the free and the home of the brave.
It's a powerful, powerful talking about the bullying and the struggles. And a lot of times our kids don't even tell us about many of the things that they may go through and once they identify as
right.
Muslims, you know, specifically after 9/11. One of the things, I was at my niece's wedding yesterday in Philadelphia, and it was,
congratulations.
And then one of the guests there, she was the daughter of one of my cousins, there's a wife of one of my cousin's children, and asked her, we were at a funeral all together last year, and the minister from his pulpit started preaching against Islam. And she was
what?
A Muslim. And this is the second funeral I've been to, and this has happened. You know, they're talking about reading the obituary, and they're talking, so this is real common. And if any other callers have had this experience, let me know. But, you know, there was a whole group of us who were Muslim, a lot of Muslims in my family, my children, and nephews. And so this preacher, I guess he knows that he held back, and all of a sudden he just started coming out against Islam. And so the young lady asked yesterday, you know, she remembered, this was last June, and she still remembered, she said, she's Christian, and she said, I was just so uncomfortable with that, and I would never go to that church again. I mean, if he, you know, was, he would be a man of the cloth, he was doing very well in the sermon, and all of a sudden he went there. She said she was offended for us and wanted to know if we were offended.
Yeah.
So we've experienced that before. And what we have to understand is that African-American community, in particular the community in transition, most of the ranks of new Muslims are coming from the African-American community, and probably every African-American in this country has a Muslim somewhere in their family,
right.
From Clarence Thomas to Uncle Thomas. I'm sure everybody will know they have a relative somewhere that's a Muslim. And so when those types of things happen, you know, we sort of take them with a grain of salt, you know, but it is offensive. And, but these types of things happen. So I identify with what the young lady is saying, specifically when you're talking about young hormonal priests or middle schoolers and high schoolers. You know, they can be very vicious.
Yeah, young kids can be more cruel than anyone with their words. They can hurt you with their words and thoughts, and they can brush up on you when they're walking down a hall. They can make you miserable, and they laugh at you and stuff like that. I've seen it a few times. Of course, I don't have that problem in my personal life, but every once in a while, when I'm out there with my wife sometimes, I remember I was in Chicago and sitting in one of the Muslim restaurants on Divan, which is named Muhammad Ali Jinnah Boulevard, after the founder of Pakistan. And, I'm sitting there with my wife and another sister, local sister, and her child. And we're at the window, and this couple came walking down the street. And when she saw the two Muslim ladies, she made all kind of funny faces and played with her hair. And, you know, started playing with it like, you know, this is hair, or whatever she was saying through the window. I put down my knife and fork, and I'm glad I did. I didn't want to bring it out in the street. But I stopped her and her boyfriend or whoever, and I explained to them that we are Muslims, and we also are Americans, and we have the blood, in my wife's case, of two oppressed people running in their veins, that of the African progenies of slaves and the Native American, so-called American Indian. And I explained to them that I'm from a military family in Boston. And I said to her that my father and uncle were in World War II and were considered considered heroes. And I said, you walked by the restaurant and made fun of them because they have their hair covered. I'm here to tell you that if you ever come across my path and do something insulting like that again, you're going to be in really, really deep trouble. You're very offensive. And then I let him go. I said, under normal circumstances, if I was not a Muslim, I would have already beaten you up or thrown you in the street in front of an oncoming car. But because I'm a Muslim, I'm telling you this, and this is what you need to hear, and get out of here. And I remember that like it was yesterday. This poem just made me remember it more. All right, we got a number of callers on the line listening to Muslim Vibe. We're getting to the final segment here. We'd love to have our listeners participate as usual. And in that regard, you're welcome to press 1 after you call the call-in number. Call-in number is 646-716-4478. I'll repeat that, 646-716-4478. To participate in the conversation, just press 1. We've covered a number of topics today, from emotional ones like this one with our Muslim sister Samira, who just spoke about some of her experiences, to some of the global and international issues. So, Imam Nadeem, when do you plan to be back in the big ATL? Oh, I'm sorry. I think we're alone now. And in that case...
I'm here. Yes, I'll be coming back tomorrow evening.
Oh, excellent.
If you'll be leaving out tomorrow afternoon. But I was looking on Al Jazeera, too. They had an opinion from a gentleman, Mark Levine. I wanted to share that with the audience, if possible.
Please.
He's talking about the whole issue of France in Mali. And he starts off by saying that the dispatching of French soldiers to beat back rapidly advancing Salafi militants in northern Mali represents the convergence of multiple circles of blowback from two centuries of French policies in Africa. Some date back to the beginning of the 19th century, and others to policies put in place during the last few years. Together, they spell potential disaster for France and the United States, two primary external Western actors in Mali today, and even more so for Mali and the surrounding countries. Only two outcomes together can prevent the nightmare of a scenario of a huge failed state in the heart of Africa spreading violence across the continent. First, the French-led assault on the north must manage to force most of the Salafi fighters out of the populated areas presently under their control and install a viable African-led security force that can hold the population centers for several years. Excuse me. If that weren't difficult enough, French and international diplomats must create a space for the establishment of a much more representative and less corrupt Malian government. That's key, less corrupt the Malian government. And that's one of the big complaints, is that the North has not been getting any of the resources, and the South has been getting the resources, and so that's contributed to the uprising or the instability, one which can and will negotiate an equitable resolution to the decades-long conflict with the Tuareg people of the North, whose latest attempt violently to carve out a quasi-independent zone in the North early last year helped create the political and security vacuum so expertly, if ruthlessly, exploited by al-Qaeda in the Maghreb and its allied radical groups. The first and largest circle of blowback returns to French colonial policy in North and West Africa, which was responsible for the creation of most of the states that are involved in the present conflict. France began deliberately to colonize large swaths of West Africa at the start of the 19th century, gaining control of what is today Mauritania and Senegal, by 1815, followed by the invasion of Algeria in 1830, Tunisia in 1831, French Guinea, the Ivory Coast, the French Sudan, which will become Mali in the 1890s, Niger in 1903, and Morocco in 1912, carved from colonialism. It is impossible to know how the map of Africa would have evolved without European colonialism to shape it. What is sure, however, is that the European scramble for Africa that dominated the 19th century and in which local rulers played a willing part whenever it served their interests, ensured that European powers would create a territorial foundation for modern nation states whose borders bore little correspondence to the ethnic and religious geography of the continent. And that's important, too, because it just carves the countries out based on, the, as you mentioned earlier, the resources.
Mm-hmm. Amazing expression you said right there, the region, the cultural and religious, what was that last sentence? Oh, are you going to play the piece? All right, we're getting to the last segment of the show, and our brother Kwame, mashallah, is coming up. Let's get him on the air. Can you hear me, brother Kwame? Assalamu alaikum.
How you doing, brother
Nassar,
brother
Nadine? Wonderful. Wonderful. Alhamdulillah. Wait till that rewinding sound stops, and we'll bring you on. I notice you've been waiting for a while. Yes. Yeah, that's quite an article there, Imam Nadim, about the situation over there in Mali because of the technical difficulties. Imam Nadim is on the road, and we'll go with you, brother Kwame. Go ahead, man. How you feeling?
Oh, good. Alhamdulillah. I mean, all praise due to Allah. I wish I had a few million dollars, and I can we can make this show a national show 5 days a week.
Ooh.
I mean, like, you know, because you brothers.
Man, now you're talking.
Yeah, we bring
yeah,
you guys.
Yeah, we could do a real good job.
Yeah, you have an excellent show. I mean, this is, you know, Islamic. You know, they have democracy nail, Islamic nail. You with you guys.
Yeah, I'm looking for it. Yeah. Good to hear, brother Kwame. Yes. The fact is, Islamic journalism has a long way to go. We need to do what we have to do to get on the mainstream channels so that the general population could hear what we're saying. Because I'm sure that even though you have a lot of knuckleheads, or as Charles Barkley would say, even though you got a lot of knuckleheads, you have a couple hundred million people that really want to know. They really want to know what's going on. We call them educated Americans. And
you guys have some way to get to them. You guys have me cracking up toward the beginning of the show about Karzai.
What happened?
That was funny. That was real funny.
He's the mayor of Kabul.
Yeah, man. Not even the mayor of Kabul. The mayor of 9 blocks in downtown Kabul. 3 blocks
but, you
by
know,
3
it,
blocks.
It's so
That's
funny.
It.
A lot of people don't realize that when you look globally, I mean, you have so many countries. I mean, even in Pakistan, if you look at the Waristan region, the government really doesn't control that.
Mm-hmm.
That's
exactly.
So, I mean, you know, it's funny. I mean, this situation in Mali, it somewhat has connotations of Afghanistan and Libya and different places, what's going on there. You know, and with this, in the bottom line, as you said, in the French and the American, it's all about resources.
And they're suffering economically. They're suffering so bad economically, so now they are looking, okay, when did we do the best? During our colonial era. So let's, just call it something else. We won't call it colonialism, but we will, you know, just go out and stretch our tentacles out throughout the planet so that we can save our own behinds, just save our own economic resources, because they're suffering. And again, the protests that you see in Greece and in Spain and all parts of Europe is the result of you basically overcharging your credit card. And now you can't pay the bill.
Did you guys see the video and it showed like the different protests that were going on throughout the world due to the financial crisis? You know, you had Greece, Spain, and other countries. I mean, the places were packed. Then they showed America with the so-called fiscal cliff, and it was nobody out in the street.
Nobody in the streets. Very unaware. Yes, this is a big problem.
Yes, big problem.
We're being lulled to sleep.
Excuse me. Have you saw this video by Hamza Youssef? He did a video called On Fair Trade.
No.
What's he saying? He deals this from an Islamic point of view. Had the Muslims, you know, how at one time we were the upright business people, and how when you went into the souk, Muslim marketplace, how you would tip the scale. You know, the Muslim, like, he, if he sold you something, he would tip the scale in your favor. But then he dwells into the whole global scene of these corporations, of these insurance companies. You know, he goes to the floods that have occurred. I mean, it's an excellent video. I think I might have posted it on your Facebook page, Brother Mansour.
Uh-huh.
It's
I
should
check it out.
Well,
because it's correct that the ethics, the business ethics of that's based on the Islamic and Sharia principle, you know, they are nearly dead. And again, when we talk about dawah, we see in history that it was the merchant that, you know, had more to do with people coming to Islam than the soldier.
Right.
You know, and because of those fair practices that you're talking about, Brother Kwame.
Yeah, even in, like, that was one reason why a lot of, even in West Africa, a lot of people came into Islam, because the business practices, and when people came in that area, they saw the fair trade, conducted themselves.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what Islam has on the pages of history. Islam has been known to come into societies, not with the sword, but with honesty and integrity and a belief system. And in Africa's case, I mean, I think the historians say that there was very little resistance and, you know, fighting and warfare. Most of the people in Africa really realized that Islam is, it fits their own civilizational goals. And with a few changes, they became huge proponents of Islam.
Yeah.
And Mandela, I remember when Mandela came out of prison back in 91, they appointed so many Muslims into judgeships and other important ministerial positions. Even though the Muslims are just 3% of the population, they were there with the ANC. They were there struggling on the side of truth. And Mandela made all these beautiful commentaries. He went to some big Muslim gathering, I remember, and he said how Islam has been so good for Africa, and Africa has been so good for Islam. So, I mean, stuff like that, man, comes from a man like Mandela. It really sticks with you.
Yeah, I mean, when people see, I know a case in America where a person, they hired a Muslim. This Muslim was so trustworthy that the person actually built a mocella for the person, for this Muslim.
Really?
Yeah, built a mocella, took a room and made the room just for him, so he can make his prayers.
Yeah. I'm sure there are many stories like this. I'd love to hear our listeners chime in on some of the beautiful aspects. Instead of always concentrating on the negatives, we have beautiful stories to tell. I remember several years ago, it was like back in the 90s, we had two beautiful brothers here, Nuri and Faraj. These were Libyans. And they had a hard time finding a job here in Atlanta. And the last I heard of them, they moved to New Haven, Connecticut. And there was a big loss for Atlanta, because these are really fine brothers, Muslim Arab brothers. And so I heard a couple of years later that they got a job at this downtown parking lot. You know how, like, we have downtown in Atlanta, you get a lot of the East African people, like Ethiopians, they run their parking lots, they're in that little booth. But up there in New Haven, these two Libyans come up there, and this Jewish guy that owns the parking lots gave him a little gig, you know, in the parking booth. And so at the end of the day, I guess the deal was the owner would come and, you know, collect the money. And so he gave him the money, and he was paying him, like, you know, $6 or $8 an hour, which I guess for a 6-8 hour day, you know, about $50, whatever, making $50 a day. And so he came to collect the money, and they gave him the cash, and he counted it, and he said, "Are you sure you got this much today?" They said, "Yeah." And why do you ask? He said, "Well, I never get this much. You guys are giving me the honest amount, and it shows that my previous managers were stealing from me." And so day after day, they gave him something like $500, and I guess he usually only got $300 from these guys. And so he said to these two Libyans, "Now here's a Jewish guy talking to Libyan Arab Muslims and telling them, look, you guys are the most honest people that I've ever met. And instead of me giving you the $50 a day, look, here's the deal. The first $100 you bring in, you put that $100 in your pocket. And then the rest of it belongs to me." So he immediately gave them a 100% raise. Instead of $50 a day, they're making $100 a day. Mm. And meanwhile, he's getting more money than he ever got before. So this is another positive outcome of
the honesty and integrity of the Muslim, the practicing Muslim.
Yeah, that's what we want. Trustworthy business people and employees and stuff like that.
Right, and they specifically told the Jewish guy, look, man, we're Muslims. We have to stand in front of God. We have to account for all these things. And if I steal from you, man, I might get away now and get an extra cheeseburger, but there's going to be a day when I'm going to really regret it. So I've got to be honest because I believe in God.
Wow.
I thought that was really impressive.
It's a beautiful story.
Yeah.
How things going up on your end, Brother Kwame, in regards to New York? Anything happening in particular? Impacting the Muslim community?
Yeah, nothing. It's the same thing. We basically had two major deaths of recent two imams in the New York, New Jersey area. We had Sheikh Abu Lamous. He just passed away yesterday.
Yeah, Abu Lamous.
The
96th Street Mosque.
Major. What's that? Sheikh Ismail had passed away from the Branford Street Mosque in Newark, New Jersey. That means it's almost like Atlantic Avenue over there in Newark. It's the same type of setup.
Yeah.
And he was a major. He was a real scholar that was here and he resided here. He just passed away.
Can you take a couple minutes and speak about both imams and give our listeners some background information, like country of origin, their age, some of the unique things they've done in their lives? Because these are two major figures that have just passed away. Just take a couple minutes and talk about them, if you would.
Yeah, Sheikh Ismail, he was from a brother from Egypt. And from what I understand, he read, I think, over 100,000 books. This brother, he wrote books. He came to Newark and basically settled amongst the indigenous Muslims and taught there and
That's
been
unique.
An imam there for a long time. Yeah, very unique. And same with Abu Lamous. I'm not sure what country of origin Abu Lamous actually was from, though. I think it was either Egypt or Syria. But he had been here for a long time and the same thing, really dealt with indigenous Muslims and Muslims in general, but really taught and very scholarly discourses. You really really learned when you listen to his discourses and stuff like that. Both of them very scholarly, both very scholarly.
JazakAllah khair. Yeah, because usually when the imams come from overseas, they are usually hired by a suburban masjid that is out there, not in the central city, to have a traditional Islamic scholar from those Muslim countries over there to actually rub shoulders with the urban Islamic, read between the lines, African-American Muslim community. This is a very big step, and it shows that they have really understood Islam for what it is. And instead of, most of the brothers, and may Allah bless them, I'm not here to say where they should work and who's supposed to pay them, but usually the big mosques out in the suburbs that only deal with the immigrant community have those types of scholars. And in this case, that they were downtown Newark and downtown 96th Street up in Manhattan, it shows a whole different demographic were able to benefit from their scholarship in their lives. So may Allah accept both of them. This is a big step for them going to the next life.
Yeah, one thing good about Abu Lamous, 90th Street, and not to Western, but 96th Street is a tough cookie to crack, because you have that board. So he was always able to maneuver, and get his get the hawk across. Yeah.
Sometimes the imam got to go up against the board.
Yeah. That's why he's been because I think they that's really, from what I understand, it was built by a Muslim government, really. A lot of things that you could be in disagreement with that happened there,
right.
But he's always able to. He knew how to knew how to work the thing.
Well, since we're getting toward the end of the show, we got so many callers on the line. I will announce one more time that Muslim Vibe is broadcasting on American Muslim 360, not to be confused with Anderson Cooper 360, who just kissed a girl the other day. But the American Muslim 360, we've been with them for now for a couple of years, Imam Nadim, and mashallah, ooh, Brother Kwame has participated in so many of our shows. And we broadcast at 1 p.m. Eastern time on Sundays on the Internet, and the shows are immediately archived. In other words, you can hear the previous shows or this show or any show in the last 2 years by going to blogtalkradio.com. That's blogtalkradio.com, and then put the two words Muslim Vibe into the search engine, and you'll be able to listen to this show and any other show at your leisure anytime during the week. Hey, that's my paid political announcement right there. We haven't had sponsors for this show, but we're still working on a couple of restaurants here in the Stone Mountain area that are going to come aboard, and eventually we're going to develop the kind of Muslim media that will be able to be supported by advertising and by, you know, instead of just asking people for money and would you donate and all that stuff and you form a 501c3. No, we want to really be a hard-hitting, well-liked, and well-pursued Muslim-oriented talk show. And eventually, you know, someone will be the first Muslim Rush Limbaugh, you know, and be the focus of a lot of attention and bring Islam up in the country for to be taken notice by people of understanding. As the Quran says, this is a message for people of understanding. And it's been that way since the first Muslims came in Mecca to right now, you know, 1,440 years later.
Inshallah, like I said, when they do add somebody, some multimillionaire comes and wants to sponsor your show five times a week.
It's going to take something like that, either grassroots support, like everybody gives $10 times 3 million, boom, there you got $30 million. Or one cat, one big player is going to have to come in and say, here, here's $10 or $20 million. I wish the best for you. I mean, like Al Jazeera started off. That station, the king of Qatar, said, here's $400 million, Brother Kwame. Here's $400 million. They hired all kinds of people. And when this $400 million is gone, I expect you guys to be up and running on advertising so I don't have to give you any more money. Well, $400 million was used up in about, you know, 10 or 15 years. And they said, look, we're almost there. Just give us a little another shot of cash. And so, of course, for these guys, I mean, $400 million, they make like $100 million a day in oil revenue, right? And you got a small little island country that has, you know, the roads are already paved, electricity is already running. So, I mean, they can do that kind of thing. So we need someone like that. Or, like I say, we need the grassroots support. We need 3 million brothers and sisters to give $10 each. And whoever can organize that, you get the Golden Globe Award from me, brother.
That's right.
You know?
We have more independence with the grassroots approach.
I'd rather have $3 million get $10 instead of one big player get $30 million. But I'll take it.
Yeah, as soon as we start talking about that one big player, they'll pull the plug on us. You know, just like Al Jazeera never criticizes Qatar. Al Jazeera never criticizes Qatar. They talk about everybody else in the world, but they won't criticize Qatar. And with the internet becoming such a stable entity, you know, I mean, you're talking about in cars, in homes, and a lot of people are even giving up their televisions and only watching television on the internet. So, you know, we're in the ground floor. Yeah, we're probably where radio was in the 1920s. Allahu alam.
Mm-hmm. Allahu alam. Like this internet format that we're on right now, this might be the way of the future.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, because before that, people read magazines and papers. And then radio, you know, came in and took over. And then television came in and took over. So I think internet is going to be the major source of information for many people in the upcoming years.
Allah knows best. I mean, we get hundreds of listeners. They tell hundreds of friends. There's going to be something that's going to happen by the grace of Allah where the hundreds will turn into millions. And before you know it, we got 10 or 20 million people listening all over the country, all over different religions, different people. You're going to have Americans calling in from Nebraska saying, you know, hey, why are y'all wearing them funny-looking hats over there? You know what I mean? And then we say to him, like, Imam Zaid Shaqir, man, he had me cracking up one time. Zaid and I were kind of riffing off each other, and he said, yeah, why y'all wear them funny-looking hats? Well, look here, Daryl. If we go to that mosque over there and wear them funny hats, we can pray on Friday, and then we'd have all day Sunday to watch football. So I think that's a good religion.
Good.
I wanted to ask you, is there any possibility you can get somebody on from Iran and talk about the sanctions that have been levered against Iran? And I was watching a video the other day ago, and it was talking about the amount of children who are not receiving treatments for, you know, diseases such as cancer and other diseases, and, you know, who are dying in Iran due to the U.S. sanctions.
So the impact of the sanctions, it's something we can work on, inshallah.
I have the ability to get some Iranian official or someone close to an official, and give me some time. I'll get a couple calls out, and maybe we can get someone in the next few shows. That's a great idea. Well, Imam Nadim, I'll tell you, the Falcons are ready to kick off. I want to say go Falcons, and they're going to kick off in about a half hour, and we're coming to the bottom of the hour, and actually it's 2:32, so we're running a little overtime. So with your permission, Allah knows best, Brother Kwame and all our listeners, we say assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. And look forward to seeing y'all, you know, next Sunday, looking the week from today. So Imam Nadim, jazakallah khair, come back safe and sound, and we'll talk to you in a while, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum.
Inshallah. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.